Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. Joining me to help manage the questions is Grace Barnett from the Compass office. Hello, Grace.
Hello.
These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in, a good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in a live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast. The virus impacts on everyone, but it impacts on them differently. Joining us this week to discuss the crisis and the future of progressive politics is David Lammy, the Labour MP for Tottenham and now Shadow Justice Minister. His most recent book, Tribes, which I've just finished reading and can't recommend enough, is a great way into David's life and his rich political thinking, not least about identity, belonging and place. The format is, as ever, is that I'll ask David a few questions and open it up to Compass members on the call for questions and comments before we finish within the hour. So, David, it's really great to have you on the call tonight. Thank you for taking the time. Normally, we start kind of brightly and positively, and we'll get to that because I've always seen you as a very bright and positive political figure. But the news and the scenes coming out of the USA are just so heartbreaking. And so big that we have to start there. So if you can, just tell us kind of where you are on for the call tonight, how you are, but tell us then how you feel and think about the death of George Floyd and what it means for race relations here in the UK, but for America, and globally, because this is now a global thing. So, where are you and how are you and what are you thinking about this, David? Thank you.
Thank you, Neil, and thank you, Compass. This is great. Look, I'm here in the House of Commons because we're doing this at a point at which MPs have been brought back to vote and decide on how we move forward. Do we all have to be here literally? And we've had this situation of queuing around the block to vote. So that's why I'm in the Commons at this point in time. It's hard, I suppose, not to be a bit emotional about George Floyd's death. And that is because, to put it bluntly, that could be me. It could be me in so many ways. And some might say, well, how could it be you, David, because you're from Britain? Well, it could be because in the end, my parents are from the Caribbean. I'm the descendant of enslaved people. It's arbitrary as to whether they would end up in the Caribbean or the United States of America. So that absolutely could be me. And to watch a man lose his life, literally watch his life slip away and take his last breath, to watch him call out for his own mother is just horrendous and heartbreaking. And I think that there are two aspects to this that are important. The first is, does this mark a moment? Because, of course, the story of African-American men dying at the hands of the police is not a new one. It's one that's been captured on film many times. I think of the name Eric Garner and others, and indeed women, actually, who've also been caught up in this nightmare. The challenge of reform in policing, of reform in prosecution, of disproportionality and endemic institutional racism is not a new story to the United States, or indeed to our own country. But we may be at a moment, and why is this so critical? I think it's because two things have happened. The first thing is Donald Trump. This coincides with an age of national populism. It coincides with a president who is driving hate, racism, prejudice, and it would appear appealing to elements of his country that are white supremacist in tone and in nature, and using language deliberately to incite. And it would appear that he has calculated that against the odds of a likely recession and a coronavirus in which she's handled it very badly, that actually doubling down on issues of race and racism is precisely the way to get re-elected. And so there's a massive moment of resistance to that. And that's where you get to the hope bit, because what we're seeing is actually, because of coronavirus, people are watching the news all across the globe. People are on social media all across the globe. People do see his tweets, do know exactly what he's up to. They can see it, it's transparent. And there is a resistance to it and a mobilization. And we pray, don't we? And we will do all we can to ensure that the progressive forces in the United States prevail in November. But we're all got a very heavy heart, because between now and November, things could get very, very, very grim indeed in the United States. And, you know, in a sense, it feels a bit like the footage, like the context that we saw in the 1960s in the United States. But the difference, I think, there was, boy, there's a big difference between Donald Trump and John F. Kennedy, or indeed even Lyndon Johnson. And somehow, when we look at Black Lives Matter and when we look at the grassroots response to this, we haven't got the Martin Luther King figure, or indeed the Malcolm X figures, but we've got something grassroots that's bubbling up across America where people are saying enough, enough. And of course it chimes with what's going on here in the UK and in the rest of the global community, because populism and nationalism are infecting the whole globe. People have seen what Donald Trump has done, and there are copycat movements that are well-financed, well-researched, have the benefit of people like Steve Bannon to advise. And of course, we have had our own issues here. The murder of Stephen Lawrence, problems with the police. We have footage here that shows excessive policing. We don't have the guns. We have an independent police complaints authority that at least is dealing with complaints and not allowing police to investigate themselves. So there is a different context, of course. And we don't have the volume either, because when we talk about minorities here, we're really genuinely talking about ethnic minorities. That population makes up about 3% of this country. But those are the themes that I pick up. And of course, there's lots of anguish, but the determination on me and all, I suppose all of us who are on this Zoom meeting at the moment, to resist, to fight, to support in solidarity with what we're seeing in the United States, and to see the back end of Donald Trump in November.
Just one more bit on that, and I'm sure we'll come back to it in the questions, which is a kind of a particular kind of compass trope, is that how do we defeat that politics of polarization and division and extremism with our politics of kindness, compassion, hope, optimism, belief in the best in people? And this is playing out in real time now, isn't it? You know, that the two different cultures. And how do we do that without being naive? It's an unfair question in a way, but it's a big question for Compass about how you kind of battle forces in a way that leads you to the sort of society that you want to end up in the belief that means always shape ends. Is that something that kind of worries you at this kind of moment? Where you can, you know.
Well, to be fair, Neil, I think my book was an attempt to make a contribution at this. And I talk a lot about, I think, the forces that are shaping global politics and populist nationalism particularly. And it's a tremendous challenge. The first thing to say is we have to be better, lot better. Better in our arguments, better in our research. We have to organize better. We have to be well-financed. This is much more than just a digital strategy. It's understanding the way that the social media particularly is being used for misinformation and disinformation. So in terms of process, there's a lot that we have to do on the progressive side to win the arguments. We have to understand the big, enormous tides that are affecting global policy. And look, you know, the truth is that after the 2008 crash and recession, and into this new period of recession, depression that's about to come, the forces of fear can win easily. Because mass unemployment, economic hardship, tough for people. And we have to be close to where people are. We have to understand their language and have a prescription for their issues. It's not, you know, I don't want to weight it in too much ideology, to be honest, because I think that doesn't quite work. But we have to meet that challenge, and we have to be better, a lot better than our opponents in terms of policy development, messaging, and thought. If we're going to do that. Now, I go into a lot of detail in my book. You might want to get into some of that. But the bottom line is, this goes back to the 1960s and much that we've learned. We have to be organized. We have to be financed. We have to be disciplined. And here in Britain, we have to remember that in a largely a two-party system, and you know, there are those of us, which would include me, that believe that there are downsides to a two-party system as we sit here with the politics that we've got. In some ways, I've always, certainly more recently, supported a more proportional representative system. But with the system that we've got, we have to recognise that the Labour Party particularly is a very broad church and only gets into office as a broad church, not as a faction.
I'm sure we'll come on to that. We will come on to that. Just give us a quick run through, so people listening tonight and listening on the podcast know a bit more about you. I mean, firstly, they can read about it here, your life, and it is a great introduction to you as a person and your politics. I can't recommend the book enough. But just give people a quick heads up on your political life, David, so they can understand where you're coming from and why.
Well, look, I am a second-generation immigrant. My parents came here from Guyana. My dad came here in 1956. My mother came a little later. She was his second wife. We grew up in Tottenham. It was a tough time to grow up in Tottenham. I had a lucky break, and my lucky break was to be plucked out as a choral scholar to go to a good school. It was a state school, but it was a state boarding school, effectively. And that changed the course of my life. And I describe it as a Billy Elliot moment, really. Only I wasn't wearing a tutu, I was wearing a dress. And I got to go to university, I got my degree as a lawyer. And like a lot of lawyers, in the end, coming back to questions of social justice, coming back to the community that I am very much from, and I'm an old-fashioned MP in that sense, I represent the patch where I'm born and raised, and still live. And I've been described as a bit of a working class hero. I'm motivated by discrimination, by class. I feel connected to the great arc of history, which is in the 20th century, saw at the beginning of that century, black and brown people colonized, formerly enslaved, saw working class people down the pit, down the mine, on the factory floor without much of a say, saw women held back, not in control of their own destiny, certainly not in control of their own bodies, and saw gay men and women absolutely traduced. And by the end of that century, because of Martin Luther King, because of Gandhi, because of Emmeline Pankhurst, because of Harvey Milk and a bunch of others, we see the people beginning to self-actualize. Now, we're still on a journey. Mm. Still haven't got equal pay. We wouldn't be discussing George Floyd if we dealt with the issues of discrimination. But I'm in that tradition. I care about those issues and I understand those issues. And I think there's solidarity across those issues. That's why I'm in the Labour Party. And I care as much, actually, about class as I do about race. But I do understand that we have to build bridges into different traditions, that in the end, we've got to be more than just a faction. In the book, I write about identity politics, and I defend identity politics because in the end, I always find it slightly curious that here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, and suddenly we get all this squealing about identity politics, and it's largely coming from men, from those who are middle class, men, and those who are extremely privileged, for whom their identity, no offense, Neil, has been the dominant theme for most of modern history. But, and this is the big but, if identity politics is the beginning and the end, then we're not going to get very far. So I do believe in common purpose, common endeavor. I do believe in an encounter culture. And this is where you, Neil, and you and I have talked about this before. We've got to get beyond tribalism. And I'm absolutely someone, you know, I was asked by David Cameron to lead a review into the criminal justice system. I accepted, pleased to make that issue a cross-party issue and to deliver a cross-party report that could be received warmly in both political traditions in our country. So you can see what motivates me. People have a view on left, right in politics. I would say that, look, it's, you know, representing Tottenham, I've always tried to stay close to issues of poverty and discrimination and class, clearly, which means I have friends on the political left. But I guess going to school in Peterborough and to some extent being, you know, a lawyer by tradition, I do understand the bridge building you build, the fact that you do have to moderate to get power. And I relate to that. And so, you know, someone once said, are you Blair or are you Brown, a few years ago? And I said, no, I'm just black. And I'll leave it for others to describe what I am. But I suppose within the Labour tradition, I'd also say that I'm a proud Christian socialist.
Yeah.
And that sometimes means that things like family, I relate to, rather than always seeing that it's the state that is responsible for lifting people up. And that does, that Christian socialist tradition, which of course can emphasize social justice, can also sometimes see you as able to relate to slightly more small C conservative places. And actually, a lot of my voters, particularly as minorities, are small C conservative in instinct. And some have described some aspects of some of the things I've said over the years as blue Labour, even though I've never liked that term at all.
So I think what you're suggesting, which is the title of this podcast series, it's bloody complicated. Your politics are quite complicated. And again, that's a thing that I've always found attractive about you, that I could never make, you weren't really a Blairite and you probably was never a Brownite and you certainly weren't a Corbynite, but you have left-wing elements of that. There is elements of blue Labour in you. And I think that makes you interesting as a person. But maybe let's just knock that on to the you know, you were kind of looking to put your hat in the ring in for the leadership election earlier in the year, and you didn't in the end, and I think that was a shame, because you wrote an article for The Observer, which I just remember thinking, this is brilliant. I mean, I was helping Clive Lewis at the time, you know, but your agenda was actually very similar to the one that Clive was pushing. It was PR, it was Progressive Alliance, you were talking about basic income, you were talking about, you know, a national service thing, which is the bit of the blue Labour. So you know, you are complicated, and that's a good thing. Do you regret not standing for the leadership now?
Absolutely not. Look, you know, I'm obviously humbled that there are lots of people wanting me to stand. I took a very prominent position, as you know, in the Brexit debate, was amongst those sort of leading the group of members of parliament calling for a people's vote. I was very robust. And let's be clear, I've been robust in debates around immigration in our country. I've been robust about aspects of that Brexit debate that I thought was xenophobic. So that put me in a particular place. And I suppose it kept me in tune very much with folk here in London, where certainly over the last few years, I felt very supported and a popular figure. However, I didn't spend the election in London. I spent the election, I spent the election knocking on doors in Yorkshire, in the Midlands, in the Northeast, in the Northwest, in Wales. And in communities like Peterborough that I spent time growing up in. And I was very clear that in the end, that job did not fall to me. I am not the man to unite the Labour Party. And even more challenging is to unite the country. And sometimes you just got to take a sober look at who's best positioned to do that. And my judgment was that Keir Starmer was best positioned to do that. And, you know, let me say this bluntly. I grew up poor and black in Tottenham in the 1980s. I remember 1983. I remember 1987. And I remember 1992. And I remember believing that we would win in all of those elections. And I remember the great Bernie Grant. But I also remember being on the receiving end of losing. And I say this very gently, in our party, quite understandably, and you know, of course, and I'm now amongst them. You know, there are folk who are get to middle class status or are middle class. We don't lose out in quite the same way under a Conservative government. And so I grew to understand what is required to win in this country. And therefore I am capable of being pragmatic and doing what's necessary in order to win, because I'm not just interested in an ideological project. I'm interested in power. And let me say also, as a minority in Britain, as a black man who wants to be in affinity with someone like George Floyd, I understand the importance of power and what it means to have no power at all and feeling powerless. So I don't make any apologies for supporting Keir Starmer, because I believe he's the right person to lead us to that place. And I was very pleased to be vice chair of his campaign. But I did reflect on it seriously. Of course, I reflected on it seriously. And I expect to play an important role. And I'm very pleased to now be in the shadow cabinet, playing the role to support our path back to power as quickly as possible.
So let's develop that thinking then, because, you know, and I was a kind of little cog in the wheel of the kind of Blair machine, and it did seize office, but it left a legacy which was a lot of positives but a lot of negatives. And then we've had the kind of, you know, the Brown, Miliband and then Corbyn years, and when we're out of office, out of power, not able to do stuff. How do you and Keir and the rest of the Labour leadership find a way through a kind of, if you want, a third way between being in office, but also really being in power and having a purpose? And that's a really difficult thing, isn't it? But that's the challenge that you and Keir and others face now, about not replicating the same big tent, which may win an office, but disappoints. How do we do something meaningful and transformative, given the fact that we've got race, climate, you know, AI, you know, all the other challenges we've got? How do we do that?
Well, the first thing is we've got to take our leadership positions very, very seriously indeed. I think Keir's right when he says, look, it's really not about going backwards or, you know, mimicking Tony or Gordon. And I'm afraid no leader, and that includes Jeremy Corbyn, you know, the template is not there. We have to forge that template. And that gets us into new territory. Now, I think at this time, clearly you've seen a change in tone from the current leadership of the Labour Party. And it's a tone that I think has a degree of humility to it, that wants to listen to the country, that wants to be sober. And I actually think, juxtaposed against Boris Johnson and his team, it's cutting through. But that's not going to be sufficient. Clearly, we're going to be in a period where we are going to have to wrestle with the tribalism and division that's gripping the country. We are going to have to hear again and not just say and speak to people. And that chimes clearly with the seats that we lost in the last general election. And let's face it, this is going to be a period where on top of austerity come recession and depression. So this political period will not be defined solely by coronavirus. It will be defined by the economic challenges that come afterwards, the global economic challenges. And when consumption drops to the levels it has, not just in this country, but in the United States as well, when it's a period of, we'll see, a lot of protectionism, trade wars. You've seen the developing hostility with China. That's the period into which we are, and that's the period into which that will determine where Labour is at the next election. That's the road that we have to navigate skillfully and carefully.
And one more from me before we kick it out to Grace and the people on the call. I mean, you've already inferred it. your own particular position, that you know that you're open to at least conversations with people of other party, and you know that Compass, you know, we have a lot of Labour Party members, but we have a lot of Green Party members and Liberal Democrats, and we have, you know, good relationships with the
Shout SNP. Out to Caroline Lucas, who I get on incredibly well with.
Yeah, and who doesn't and who wouldn't, you know. But actually, like Liz Saville Roberts from Plaid Cymru is very good, and we've had Leila Moran on here, and you know, Ed Davey. These are people that we should be doing business with. Now, will the? I mean, my worry is that, you know, quite understandably, Keir's got a big personal mandate, that the Labour Party tries to make itself the big tent again, and doesn't see itself as the biggest tent on the campsite. And by the time, you know, maybe if the polls don't turn around effectively, you know, before the next election, it becomes too late. Do you think we can open the Labour Party up both to proportional representation, which you support, and to the politics of pluralism? Well,
all of those colleagues that you've mentioned, I have respect for personally and get on well with, and have worked across the political divide with. I would not describe myself, I mean, I couldn't imagine myself in another political party, I've got to tell you. And there were some low days. There were some low days, particularly after the referendum. And I'm certainly on record saying I'm feeling incredibly lonely in the Labour Party. There was a period where the Labour Party were infighting. There was a second leadership challenge to Jeremy Corbyn. I appeared to be the only person at that point focusing on Brexit. And on my deep concerns when the Labour Party was looking very inward, and I felt very lonely. And it was during that period that one started to forge really deep relationships with other political parties, and you saw the merits in other traditions. Look, I personally think you've always got to be open where you can find solidarity. I think that we have to understand that I think that some of the limitations of a first-past-the-post system, you know, the Tories are coming forward with yet another proposal to change constituencies and boundary reviews, and we know why they're doing that. These are decisions we'll have to reach collectively in shadow cabinet, so it's not for me to form a conclusion as to how those discussions go. And I think there'll be differences of opinion around that table. But it seems to me that if you're in the business of building a big tent, then you will be in the business of, and you have to be in office, then you are naturally going to be in a place where you are sympathetic and recognizing other traditions. And then it's a decision of political strategy as to whether you are seeking to smother those other traditions and engulf them in your own party, or whether you are seeking to be in an alliance with those other traditions in some ways. And you can see in our own history, whether it's the New Labour project in 1994, really, and moving forward, and the work with between Tony Blair and Paddy Ashdown, or whether you go back to the 1970s, and the way in which we had to, in order to get legislation through, rely on deep conversations with other parties. James Graham captures that very well in his fantastic play, This House. But look, we've been here before. There are different ways to do it. But your question, Neil, is this important? I suppose the answer is, yes, it is.
Hello, this is Grace from the Compass office, interrupting for a moment.
I'm lucky enough to come from a large and politically diverse family. We really did have the full political spectrum represented over Christmas dinner, but in spite of our differences, we still actually like each other. I've always known, because of this, that politics should be more about listening and learning from the people we disagree with than shouting at them and fighting with them. And of course, I've definitely known for a long time that it really is bloody complicated. So I was so happy that when one day I discovered Compass, quite by accident, through their brilliant work on the Progressive Alliance in the 2017 general election. Since then, it's been an absolute pleasure to once again be part of a political family where talking to people in different political parties, admitting that you alone don't have all the answers, is not just okay, but actively encouraged. So if you'd like to find out more about Compass, you can visit compassonline.org.uk.
And now, back to the conversation.
Now, Grace, over to you. Start getting some of the members on to ask David, you know, proper questions, difficult questions.
Yeah, got some really hard
Thanks,
ones.
Grace.
Okay. All right, Matthew Hulbert, you should be able to talk to us now. Can you hear us?
Hi. Hi, David. Thank you so much for what's been really, really, really interesting, a really pivotal moment to be hearing from you. I'd like to ask if there's anything at all, at least in this sense, that we can learn from the fairly dreadful, very dreadful populists and nationalists that now lead us here and lead in the America and elsewhere. They have very simple messages, and often we as progressives are rather more nuanced and don't have simple messages. How do we, is that something that we can learn from what are otherwise fairly dreadful people?
Well, you know, even the word progressive is not a word that easily translates. We have to recognise that one of the challenges of that the political left, centre-left progressive movements have across the world is this increasing profile of city-based, university-educated, policy, ideologically, sometimes can be quite heavy, and recognise parts of the electorate that haven't gone to university. Parts of the electorate don't live in cities, they live in towns or they live in suburbs. That does mean quite a lot of emphasis on tone and on languages and on messaging. And, you know, that's the process stuff of politics, but you really don't get anywhere unless you start to digest that and what that's about. So I think there is a task for us here in this country. And it's a task in which we have to be in partnership with sister parties across the global community, who some of whom have overcome these challenges and some of whom absolutely face these challenges as squarely as we do. And it's clear that there are sadly things that we need to learn. The challenge of finance is important. Our political opponents are very, very well financed at the moment. The challenge of misinformation and disinformation and the way that social media is being used is incredibly important. I'm afraid I do believe, and this is not to be a conspiracy theorist, but clearly there are alliances that are being forged with countries that we should be very sceptical and nervous about, often to the east of us. And one's got to, you know, what are those motives? Oligarchs financing things and other things, if you know what I mean. I'm not saying that we can take money in that way, but we've got to understand our opponents in a much, much bigger way in order to meet them and beat them. But I do think that, how can I put this in simplistic global terms, I believe that there are sort of two important engines of the world. Now, clearly the business of innovation, industry, business is hugely important, and wealth creation matters, it seems to me. But that's not the kind of engine I'm talking about. I'm talking about the global south, often people of colour that are a massive engine of the world, the clothes that we're wearing, the food that gets picked, that we eat, much of the world's manufacturing is being done in these parts of the world. And then there is another engine of the world, and that engine of the world in both Europe and the UK, and indeed in America, is often found in places that have felt quite left behind over this last period. And that engine is often, not always or exclusively, but it is white and it is working class. And it's clear that the our political opponents have found some alliance there. Now, some of that has, of course, has been stoked in a particular way, and you can see, sadly, what Donald Trump is up to. It's so transparent. But there are vast elements of that that are about place, belonging, that are about understanding ways of being and ways of life. I try and go into this depth in my book when I go back to the city of Peterborough. And the Labour Party and progressive forces have got to get into that place, as our opponents have been able to get into that place. I'm very clear that is part of the route back to power, because those two engines that I describe, whether they are in the global south or whether they are in here in a country like ours, in a city like Wigan, where my good friend Lisa Nandy is the MP, those engines in the end are part of the coalition that gets you over that hefty line to power.
For getting into power, Barbara Clark, can you hear us? Can you speak to us?
Yes.
Would you like to ask your first question about electoral alliances? A few people were asking about this, so I thought I'd bring you on with that one.
Yes, very simple question, David. What is your view of a one-off informal progressive alliance for fighting the next election in order to start to turn around some of the awful things that have been happening?
Well, I mean, in the past, I'm on record as calling for a progressive alliance. I wanted a progressive alliance to deal with the aftermath of Brexit and to forge a second referendum. And I was very unhappy when that alliance broke down, really, and the prospects of that alliance broke down. I was unhappy with the direction in which the leadership of our party was going at that time. I was unhappy with friends like Chuka and Muna and walking off in the way that they had, and the sort of breakup of that. And I had worked very well with Caroline Lucas on the second referendum campaign. I'd worked well with Anna Soubry. I'd worked well with Jo Swinson, in fact, and then she went off in a slightly different direction. So I'm on record as having called for that in the past. I'm afraid I can't predict where we're going to get to now, and that's in part because, as is the way in politics, things can change on a dime, and we are exiting the European Union. That's happening, and that I'm quite sure that by the time we get to the next general election, that the big theme will be the post-coronavirus economic theme, of which Brexit may have played a part for sure. Because there are many of us who've expressed a view of what we'd expect to happen to the British economy after we exited the European Union. But I suspect the global downturn after coronavirus would have played an even bigger role. So that is what will define this next period. And I can't come to a conclusion as to where that leaves issues like a progressive alliance at this point.
Okay. Moving on now to something a bit more local. Madeline, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yes, I can, yes.
Would you like to ask your question you had? It was really good.
Yeah. I'm interested in the fact that, you know, one of the things that's really occurred in this crisis period is the kind of explosion of local level leadership. At a time when local councils have basically been enfeebled and centralisation is the norm, and yet local leadership and local passion and support has been the defining feature of this crisis, and yet it's almost impossible for local people to feel represented in local councils. Local councillors are fundamentally elected from the big political parties and you can't get in. And so there's this real disconnect between local representation and local leadership. And I wonder what can be done to change that.
Well, thank you. I should say thank you, Barbara, but thank you, Madeline, for that. Big shout out to Labour local authorities doing extraordinary things and demonstrating extraordinary innovation at a time when the cupboard has been almost bare. And it's just not been sung sufficiently. I have a chapter in my book dedicated to this subject. I go up to Wigan and see innovation there with how they are creating cooperatives, how they are getting alongside people who've got no food, who've got no jobs, employing people, but doing it with tremendous dignity. And in my own area, I see tremendous work. I mean, actually, the mutual aid work that's come out of this has been extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. Now, look, politically, of course, for me, it can't just be about, you know, philanthropy and individual endeavor in that sense, because otherwise we're going back to a sort of Victorian period. I want the state to be engaged, but nevertheless, it has been extraordinary, and local authorities have been right at the center of that. And actually, it's been really interesting under Keir to see local authority leadership brought into the shadow cabinet, and in our meetings, really engaged with what they're up to on the front line. Devolution is necessary. I am of the view that Britain is heavily centralised, and if you look at where the success stories are, countries like Canada, countries like Germany and other Northern European countries, it does feel to me that more federated model where there's much more local delivery is succeeding more, better at least, than these heavily centralized states where you're very remote from where the action is and where ordinary people is and where, look, and I'm representing obviously one of the most deprived constituencies in the country in many ways. But nevertheless, it is still in London. It still is proximate to employment in a way that many colleagues' seats are not. So I really hear what you're saying. And I think that there's lots of innovation. There's need for renewal at a local level. But that goes beyond just the local authority level. One of the things I'm concerned about as Shadow Justice Secretary is important traditions like our magistrates. We've had a direction of travel in Britain that's actually about making magistrates court, you know, cutting them. They're more and more remote. I've raised concerns in my review about ethnic minority magistrates, but equally, where are the working class magistrates of whatever colour? And how do we get that local tradition where justice is local and proximate to local communities back? That's a big agenda, actually. Or the justice system ossifies and is a top-down thing. So I'm with you there, lots of thinking ahead. And clearly, our understanding of, and this goes back to belonging, place, neighbourhood, family, locality, really, 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 really important. And it does mean that we're going to have to get out of the cities. Our votes are found in the cities often, and we are going to have to get out of the cities into those towns. And clearly, Lisa Nandy brought a lot to the debate in that regard for our leadership election.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The next two questions are going to do them together because they're quite similar. David Edgar, just so you can get ready, David.
A couple of weeks ago, Paul Mason said that there had to be an alliance between the centre and the left, including what he called the authoritarian left, in red wall seats. I don't think the 2019 Labour vote or even the 2017 Labour vote was significantly xenophobic. But it does seem that the next 2 million votes that we need to win next time do include a large number of people who are socially conservative, and social conservatism is itself a wide tent, but there clearly is very considerable hostility to immigration in the socially conservative package. And I guess the question simply is, do we concede or confront? And if it's confront, how do we do that?
I think that my own sense is this is more nuanced than it's sometimes conveyed. And your question and the spectre of social conservatism suggests that you appreciate the nuance, because there's a big difference between being socially conservative. And I've already said that one of the traditions that definitely runs through me and runs through my writing is a Christian socialist tradition. And that's a tradition that definitely understands social conservatism and where that might come from. And that is not to be disparaged in any sense. And it's certainly not necessarily by any stretch xenophobic. Although you would expect me within cabinet to have very strong views about xenophobia and about issues like institutional racism. And it's important to bring those views to bear. As to immigration and place, I think that moves around. It is definitely the case historically that economic challenge can raise the spectre of change in immigration. It can loom much larger in people's lives and people's minds, for sure, and can certainly be ramped up by the political right, and I think has been. And that is one of the themes. It's why, very sadly, Donald Trump is doubling down in the most horrendous way on issues of race in America as we speak. But it is also the case that people can look again. So it's really, really interesting. If you look at some of the work that came out yesterday on breakthrough moments in the political cycle in this last period, it is clear that the Dominic Cummings controversy has really broken through to the public. And then there has been this decline in support for the government as a consequence of that moment where trust is breached. But what came in number two? Windrush came in number two as the last time that the public really suddenly saw something very, very differently. And I think also that in relation to our NHS workers, who are our NHS and who are our care workers, there has been a crystallizing and an understanding in the public that often we rely on immigration in a breakthrough moment in a way that, you know, has not been very dominant in the debates in Britain over the last few years. So this can change and move, of course, but nevertheless, we have to listen and hear people. We have to have a language that they understand, and we have to be, look, you know, something like a 4-day week. Intellectually, I understand what that's about, but I'm afraid in the last general election, I think a lot of folk that I knocked on their doors saw that as not something they were asking for and were confused by it. It almost suggested a Labour didn't have the appetite to support workers, almost, people thought. It didn't land. Some of our spending didn't land. Never mind issues of immigration. So I think your question is on point. I think we're going to have to do a lot of thinking. I haven't got all the answers. I suggest some answers in my book, which I'd encourage you to read as a contribution. One of the things I raise in my book, but it, you know, this is not Labour Party policy, but it's an interesting issue, which is that some of our Northern European cousins look at immigration more regionally. They allow regions to vary their attitude to those who would newly arrive, i.e. you would expect in London, when you first arrive and get your NI number, you can work in London, they might have a view, but there might be other parts of the region that go in a different direction. Things like that will have to be looked at in greater detail, I suspect.
Okay, next question. We're going to try and squeeze in a couple more before the end. So Avila Kilmurry, can you hear us and can you speak to us?
Hi, David, I agree with you that we need to look at expanding the tent, and that won't be done on ideology, but it does have to be done on values. And one of the values that I'm concerned about is the value of human rights, particularly in the context of the new counter-terrorism and sentencing bill, which brings in much longer prison sentences for those terrorist offences, but importantly also has grossly intrusive investigative measures which actually goes beyond it reduces the burden of proof that the current civil law standards have. And speaking from Belfast, I'm just worried about the impact of repressive legislation. And I'm wondering what the Labour Party can do in terms of opposing this bill.
Well, look, I mean, terrorism is a very serious business. This legislation follows in the wake of what we saw at Fishmongers Arms and some pretty serious events in Streatham and other places. But of course, we're always balancing. You've got to balance human rights against that and individual rights. I think at the time that we're having this is that there remains a very, very serious, substantial threat to this country, and it's something that worries the public. And I might say that I lost a very dear friend in the London bombings. So, that impact of terrorism is very real. As a lawyer myself, I obviously hear the concerns about proportionality. And I think that that's at the heart of what you were saying. And you would always expect the Labour Party to be making the debate about balance and proportionality in relation to this subject. But we have to take very seriously the threat, terrorist threat. And I think that when the government brought forward their emergency legislation in February, whilst we raised many questions, we also understood that the situation in which a group of terrorist offenders were about to be shortly released, and that indeed the offences that we'd seen in Britain had been committed by those, many of whom had been prisoners before, did need attention. And as a responsible opposition, I think it's important for us to understand the need for that attention and to therefore to support change where it's necessary and where it's proportionate.
Okay, so I think this is going to be the last one from the audience.
What a shame!
Yeah, I know, there's been so many, it's been particularly difficult to use today.
Sorry for my long answers.
No, they were brilliant. So Jana, can you hear us and can you speak?
Yeah, so one's a question on representation, really, or I guess just sort of with everything that's going on in the, you know, watching the States with George Floyd, you know, and it opens up this moment where we get to talk every once in a while about race and about representation and all that kind of stuff. And obviously it's, you know, ironic but not good enough that the only time we talk about it is when there's a black MP talking, and it's not fair to ask you, why should you have to answer the question? Do you know
what
I mean?
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, but I feel the same. You know, I'm from
I feel very, very strongly. I just got to get in there. Thank you for saying that. I think that you're seeing a lot on social media, and I can say this, there is a weariness in the black community. People keep using the phrase, I'm tired, of making the same debates. And there is a desire, I think, for majority communities to have this conversation. For not always me to be in public life talking about these subjects, but for colleagues that don't look like me, really feeling comfortable leading on this subject matter. So thank you very much for saying that.
No, not at all, but I'm sort of going to ask you to help solve the problem anyway, because, you know, I'm similar situation. I'm not black, I'm brown, but, you know, it's often you're in that situation, you've got to answer it. For me, for a long time growing up, it was in the context of 9/11, answering all those questions, where are you from, where are you really from, etc. But I guess my real question is, like, how do we get this conversation to continue? And to that broaden out, and how do we get some of your, you know, white colleagues in Parliament to like start actually having the conversation and start having it a bit more honestly and deeply as well about the party and about all the parties, really. I don't think any of the kind of progressive parties, we like to kind of throw rocks at the Tories, but, you know, if you start looking under the hood and start looking at the staff structures and walking into meetings, it's, you know, it is the lack of representation. An opportunity for people of, you know, people of colour is really, it's so stark across the trade union movement, even NGOs, whatever you want to say, across that whole progressive movement. So, like, how do we sustain that conversation beyond this moment? And how do we sort of make it so it's not just the one brown guy on the call and the one black guy on the call having to bring it up at the end?
Well, Look, thank you again. I guess I feel that part of this is being honest about our history. And I say that, you know, and history in Britain is not just about the two H's, which is, you know, Henry VIII and defeating Hitler. There's a hell of a lot in between. And I don't say that because I want people to walk around feeling shame and guilt entirely about the colonial period. But unless there's a reckoning with that period and an honesty about that period, I'm afraid mistakes get made. And Windrush is an example of that, you see, because the Windrush story did not just begin in 1958 when these people came from the Caribbean to the motherland. They came from the Caribbean because there weren't jobs in the Caribbean, and that's because the Caribbean ran down substantially after the end of the slave trade and as we moved into the early 20th century. And the sort of travesty of them not being British citizens is kind of unbelievable when you think that the minute that their ancestors were brought from the continent of Africa to the Caribbean, of course they were British citizens. By definition, that's what they became, as it were. So it was quite painful, very painful, to not really have that even referenced. And that's because of a discomfort in our story and that story. And being able to hold that story alongside other stories, like the story of class and the way that that has played out in the last few hundred years, in particularly in British history. So until we're completely comfortable with that, it's going to be very hard to see how people can feel ownership in this area, apart from these moments. And, you know, we mustn't look at America and think this is all about them and their perennial fights about race. We must also recognize that there are aspects of that story here in Europe and in our own countries, although for lots of reasons, there are huge and very significant differences as well. I want a sustained debate. You know, I remember the murder and the death and the controversy and travesty of Stephen Lawrence's murder and what happened. It's very painful that those issues are sort of still with us. I think there have been improvements, but they're still with us. And I guess that the thing that I'm taking away increasingly, and this is much broader than race, by the way, much, much broader, is that progress, you know, now I'm sort of, you know, getting to, you know, into almost my fifth decade on the planet. It's that understanding that progress is not linear. It just isn't. That it can be two steps forwards and three steps backwards, and that you have to keep fighting the fight. And the hope for me comes, it does come with the children of the baby boomers. I do think the millennials, Generation Y, are a great generation. I think they're going to change the world. I think they're going to make the 60s look tame. But they're not quite on the levers of power. And in a way, my generation, you know, Neil, sort of Generation X, we're mini boomers. And we're a small generation, really. You know, grew up under Thatcher. Frankly, we had a economy that was booming for many, many years. So I think that I'm hopeful about the future, but we're in this transition point. And it's really interesting to see the articulacy amongst this generation on issues of race and diversity, getting into it, reading the books. There's lots to, you know, in the end, it's about education, educating yourself and feeling the need to educate yourself about things that people like me know deeply and understand deeply. And I think that is beginning to happen amongst younger generations particularly. And that does mark the possibility for slightly more sustained and permanent fundamental change than the incremental change on issues like race that we've seen over time. But the other thing I'd say, and I'd end here, and this feels a bit tough, but it's true. My mother used to say to me growing up, live up to your ancestors' prayers. I didn't really understand what that meant. And obviously, as I started to come of age, I really knew, begun to understand what she meant. What she meant was, as hard as you might think you've got it, it's not as hard as your ancestors had it. And for a lot of us in progressive traditions, that is the case, that is true. And so we have to keep that in mind, one. And two, for those of us who are more fortunate, but still describe ourselves as being progressive, the thing that we have going on is empathy and compassion. And it's how we extend that and how we use the messaging and language to extend that beyond just our small tribe in order to garner power. So live up to your ancestors' prayers, as tough as it is. Actually, on the whole, you know, with each successive generation, we do see improvement. But part of that is organizing, mobilizing, education, and a degree of resistance and tenacity.
David Lammy, that was fantastic. You're getting huge plaudits in the chat box. Thank you so much. I just want to give a big shout out to Living Under One Sun, which is a community hub in Tottenham. And we're going to promote that this week. We're going to start doing that. Your office told me that was one of your charities in your constituency that you're
great on. So anyone who can give to Living Under One Sun, that's a wonderful, wonderful charity doing great work locally.
So we'll give that a big push this week. Thank you so much. Thank you for everyone on the call. Just to let you know that next week we'll be joined by the Labour MP, Shadow Communities and Local Government Secretary, Steve Reid. He will be joined in turn by Mike Wilson, who runs an exciting community settlement in South London. And they'll explore Compass's big idea of 45-degree change, where the horizontal meets the vertical. So they'll be discussing that next week. And also next week you'll get a rest from me as Francis Foley, our new Deputy Director, will be hosting the podcast. Until then, David Lammy, you've been absolutely brilliant. People will love listening to that. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for all that you're doing. And thank you everyone on the call tonight for listening, asking questions. Please, David and everyone, keep safe and keep well. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore compass, or compass at compass office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.